and he wondered if there was a roof overhead. "You have a visitor," Kayla said. She sounded as though she were about to laugh. Simon turned, lowering Azura to a better position. Indiriel stood there, chain-marked arms crossed, leaning against the stone doorframe. He smiled broadly, flashing white teeth. "Don't mind me," he said. "By all means, celebrate. I remember when I defeated this room before Kai. I wouldn't let him hear the end of it for 3 days." Simon tried to keep his face from turning red, but he wasn't sure he had succeeded. "I haven't beaten the room yet." "Would you like to?" Simon stood for a moment, irrationally waiting for a trap. "Yes." "Then watch," Indiriel said. He stepped forward, black Nye cloak billowing around him, and stretched his hand out to summon his pitted sword. When one of the clear spots in the rain arrived, he walked out, falling into a stance that Simon recognized as the first of the necessary forms. Watching the Overlord, Simon released his liquid steel and drove Azura down into the soft earth, letting his power evaporate. He couldn't challenge this room without enough strength to wield his blade, so he needed to give the steel enough time to fully recover before Indiriel finished. As Indiriel walked through the third form, with his body twisted almost backward, Simon caught a glimpse of the other man's face. He had his eyes firmly shut. He flowed from form to form, showing the ease of decades of practice, moving with a skill and confidence that Simon could only imitate. Instead of following the direction of the rain, it seemed almost that the rain followed him, parting just in time to avoid his blade. Every time Simon saw his face, his eyes were closed. It only took Indiriel about a minute to work his way to the far side of the room. As soon as he reached the far stone door, sword stretched out to one side in the final form, the rain stopped. The light even brightened, until it seemed almost as though the sun had risen behind the clouds. Indiriel smiled at Simon from across the garden and stepped out on the grass, walking back. The rain didn't start up again. It seemed he had earned the right to cross as he wished. Simon stepped forward to meet the older swordsman halfway, but as soon as he did, a tiny cloud detached itself from the overcast cover overhead. It flew over until it rested directly over Simon, and then it unleashed a waterfall of torrential rains. Hastily, Simon leaped to the side, but the cloud followed him, drenching him in heavy raindrops. Soaked to the bone, he walked back to the stone platform. The cloud followed him even there, giving him a few last drops as though to teach him a lesson. When it finished, it flew back to join the other clouds overhead. "You could have warned me that would happen," Simon said.
"You were in no danger this time," Kayla said primly. "I was eager to see what would happen."
"You knew exactly what would happen."
"Then I was eager to watch."
Indiriel finally reached Simon, his blade still held lightly in one hand. "Kai taught you the forms?" he asked, as though he already knew the answer. Simon shrugged. "He walked me through some of them, but I watched Kai run through the whole routine every morning all summer. I know them well enough."
"He didn't..."
Indiriel cut himself off by shaking his head. "He should have taught you the forms in your first week, Simon. I don't know what he thought he was doing with you."
"I don't ever know what Kai thinks he's doing."
"I do," Kayla sent. "Trust me, knowing doesn't help."
"Anyway," Indiriel went on, "the room responds to you. That's the trick. I had to try a dozen times before I figured it out. If you try to respond to what the rain garden shows you, you'll never get there. You have to lead and let the room respond to you." Nervously, Simon eyed the clouds, which had started to release a soft downpour once again. Indiriel noticed. "Don't worry about the cats," he said. "They won't maim you too bad before I get to you, and I'll take you right back to the pool for healing." Simon thought he was being awfully casual about the maiming part, but he did as Indiriel suggested, taking a deep breath and exhaling his fear. Summoning steel, he pulled Azura from the earth. Then he stood, waiting for the clear spot in the rain.
Don't wait, Indiriel said. Let the room react to you.
So Simon closed his eyes and stepped forward into the opening stance, crouched and ready to strike. No drops struck him, so he moved ahead. He forgot about the rain, about Indiriel behind him, about Valen's looming threat. He focused on nothing but the image of Kai running from one form to another amid the waving grasses of Chaka's garden. Simon did as he had so often seen his master do, moving forward almost without effort. With his eyes closed like this, it was almost like practice, and he lost himself in the familiar rhythm of moving from stance to stance.
You should open your eyes, Kayla suggested.
Simon did so, to find that he was inches from the wolf-carved stone door, all the way on the other side of the rain garden. Behind him, the sound of the rain had vanished. Simon turned around, exultant, ready to shout with joy. He found himself looking into the frozen eyes of 1,000 long-necked cats, their translucent bodies made up of flowing rainwater. Simon froze, keeping Azura cupped in both hands, as the final form dictated. He was ready to fight if he had to, but he didn't like his odds against this crowd. It seemed as though every raindrop had become a deadly cat, their icicle fangs visible through transparent mouths. They eyed him with what looked like hunger, liquid ears occasionally flicking to one side or the other. Too afraid to move, Simon stood still, frozen, with Azura in one hand. If they attacked, he would be overwhelmed in seconds, so he certainly didn't want to provoke them. Moving his eyes as little as possible, he looked up and across the garden at Indiriel. He still stood in the same position, lounging casually against the door back to the courtyard. Simon looked back down at the cats. A single one of the long-necked creatures let out a contented meow, and the cats all bared their icicle teeth in horrible smiles. Once again, Simon wondered if he was about to be eaten. Their bodies liquefied, everything but their frozen teeth, and they flowed into one another in a horrible vortex of swirling ice and water. The icy wind that flew out of their cyclone was so cold it bit into Simon's skin. He had to throw up an arm to defend his face against the freezing assault. After a few dozen seconds, the whirling stopped, and the storm condensed into a single shape that fell down onto the grass. It was a horn, like the one the watchman back in Myria had used to sound an alert at the gates. Unlike any other horn Simon had ever seen, this one wasn't made of metal. Frosted ice made up its mouth, and most of the tubing seemed formed from blown glass. Inside one particularly fat tube in the middle, Simon saw a still-moving puddle of water. For a moment, Simon wondered how a horn made of ice, water, and glass would even make any sound. He reminded himself where he was. If the horn had been made out of shadow and moonbeams, it would still make some kind of sound. He reached down and scooped up the horn, which was exactly as cold as he had expected. Excitement rose up inside of him, and he held the horn aloft for Indiriel to see.
Congratulations, Kayla said. It certainly took you long enough.
Indiriel walked over, and Simon noted that no rogue storm clouds drenched him.
Well done, Simon. At this rate, you might even be able to challenge another power before we have to fight Valen again. That's good. You'll need as much as you can get against the Grandmasters.
I wasn't sure this room even had a power, Simon said.
Most rooms do, Indiriel responded. When Kai first made it past this room, the Guardians didn't think he was worthy. They let him pass, but he didn't earn the horn. He had to go back and try again for months before they finally gave it to him. Denner couldn't convince Benson to give him the steel until after almost a year of trying. A whole new world of possibilities was opening up to Simon. What about the forge? I defeated that guardian, and I beat those candle guys in the library, too, but they told me there was no other power.
If you defeat the guardian, you get to pass the room. If you defeat the Guardian with a distinction, you earn their power. Indiriel shrugged.
At least, that's how Valen used to explain it to us. It seems there are all sorts of rules that vary from room to room. Simon looked down at the instrument in his hand. He had to shift it to his left, because the cold was about to burn his palm. What's this, then?
The Frozen Horn, Indiriel responded. It was an artifact Valen stole from Helgard and brought here, attuning it to Valenhall instead. It closes gates. Curiously, Simon raised the horn to his lips and blew. A weak sort of whistling sound emerged from the end, but nothing else happened.
Indiriel chuckled. It doesn't work in a territory. And there's more than one way to use it. The easiest is to call its power into your sword, like this.
He concentrated for a moment, and his cracked dragon's fang began to vibrate like a struck tuning fork.
This is easy and quick, and it's the way we use it most often. Swing your sword through a gate, he swung his blade from left to right for emphasis, and the gate vanishes. You could, instead, summon the horn and blow it. Don't, though.
Why?
For one thing, there's only the one horn. If you summon it, nobody else can use it while you have it. For another, it's not as efficient if you sound the horn manually. It will still close gates, but the process takes longer, and it takes over an hour before you can use it again. If you simply call the sound into your sword, the power recovers in seconds.
Why? Simon asked again.
Indiriel looked at Simon blankly. After a few seconds, he simply spread his hands and shrugged.
The Wanderer used to speak of metaphysical distance and a link between the territory and its powers, Kayla said, as though that explained everything.
Thanks for the help, Simon responded with a mental sigh.
He was growing tired of explanations that didn't give him any real information.
Still, that wasn't enough to drown out his excitement over the Frozen Horn. At last, he had moved one step ahead. Now he could finally discover what was on the other side of this door. He moved forward and put his hand on the next door, the one with the carving of the wolf.
Simon, someone called from the far door. Simon turned around to see Olyssa, her goggles pushed up on her forehead and a pair of work gloves clutched in one hand.
I need you in the workshop. We need a traveler, and for some reason Andra can't make this work.
Simon looked longingly at the next door, but he wasn't willing to open it if he wasn't prepared to walk through. As far as he knew, whatever was on the other side would grab him and instantly drag him through. Olyssa appeared to notice Indiriel for the first time, and she smiled politely.
Feeling better, I see. You were a mess the last time I saw you.
Indiriel swept a bow.
Indeed I was, and thank you for your hospitality and care.
I never did catch your name.
Indiriel, son of Elias, he responded casually. For a moment, Simon wondered if Olyssa would recognize the name and drop down to one knee or something. But she simply smiled and gave the faint suggestion of a curtsy.
Olyssa Agnos, if you would like to repay me for your care, you would be doing me a great service by coming with Simon into the workshop. I could probably use both of you.
Indiriel's smile widened, as though he found the whole thing amusing. I welcome the opportunity to repay my debt. Come on, Simon. Simon gazed at the next door.
But...
I wouldn't open that now if I were you, Indiriel said. What waits on the other side will grab you and drag you through.
I knew it, Simon thought.
He sighed regretfully and turned, following Indiriel out of the room.
So tell me, Indiriel said to Olyssa, what is this workshop?
Alan sat at Grandmaster Naraka's bedside, resting on the edge of a padded stool that someone had found for him. His surroundings, Grandmaster Naraka's private rooms, were well made and simply decorated. Her bed looked more like the simple cot Alan had used back in Myria than the huge four-poster they had provided him here, and portraits of her family lined the walls. She lay on her bed, asleep, the stump of her right arm wrapped in layers of bandages. He had been unable to find that one, but her left hand had, somehow, made it through the gate with them to Elysia.
He had used the rose light of Elysia to reattach the hand at the wrist, though she was still unable to move it. It twitched occasionally as she slept, its fingers curling and uncurling like a dying spider. The flesh at the base of the hand was ringed by scar tissue, like a pink noose. Alan had finally extracted himself from the gold armor, and though he was dressed now in a simple gray shirt and pants, the only clothes he could find that weren't fit for a palace, he still smelled like metal. He had tried to sleep once they returned, after giving his report to the remaining grandmasters, but he had been unable to stop his mind from working. So, he had come here. Listening to the other grandmasters talk, it seemed that every other attack had gone as badly as his. In fact, he had been luckier than some. One Tartarus traveler had managed to escape through her territory, taking a few soldiers with her. All told, he had only lost about a dozen people, as well as one Grandmaster's hand. One attack had been eliminated to a man, with Grandmaster Asphodel losing her life. Another attack resulted in the death of Grandmaster Tartarus, if no one else. Two Grandmasters dead, and one out of the fight. They hadn't managed to destroy even one hanging tree. "Why?" Alan had asked the remaining Grandmasters. "How did we fail so badly?" "Because they knew we were coming," they had responded. "Somehow, they knew exactly where we would strike, and they were ready for us." Even without a direct answer, Alan knew the other reason. The reason they didn't mention, but the word that was now on everybody's lips. Valenhal. Based on the messages they had recovered before her death, Grandmaster Asphodel had managed to successfully take her team around Overlord Eli's defenses. She had her strike team in place with no casualties, and even had the hanging tree in sight. The last message from her was that there was only one remaining guard, an unshaven man in a brown cloak, carrying a huge red and gold book. In case he was a traveler, she planned to overwhelm him in an ambush and report her success afterward. They had received no further messages until, according to Grandmaster Avernus, a Valenhal traveler had thrown them Grandmaster Asphodel's head in a sack. Sick of sitting still, Alan called out to his new power, a comforting pink light that waited in the distance, calling out to him like the promise of home at the end of a long journey. He tapped into that light, calling forth the rose power of healing. Pale, reddish light bloomed in his hand, unfolding into layers like an actual rose. He held the delicate sculpture of pink light and moved his hand closer to Grandmaster Naraka's hand, letting the petals of light drift out of his hand and into her wrist like a paper ship drifting on the tides. The light sank into her scars and her flesh glowed as though lit from within. The hand spasmed and relaxed, the skin smoothing out. Muscles writhed around the wrist, building themselves up. The scar shrank slightly. Grandmaster Naraka's breath caught, but after a few seconds, though it might have been Alan's imagination, she seemed to breathe more easily than before. Alan himself could hardly breathe at all. He panted as though he had just run uphill carrying a mule on his back. The rose light tired him in a way that the gold and the green did not, so that even one healing felt like building a new barn. These repeat recovery sessions that he had continued, one after another, all night, were putting him on the edge of passing out. And still, he couldn't sleep. Where was Simon? He still hadn't returned, and both Grandmaster Endros and Avernus were ready to declare him an ally of Damasca. Alan had vouched for him, assuring them that Simon would never have sided with Damasca, and if it looked like he had done so, then it was probably for a good reason. He had his own suspicions. He suspected that Simon was trying to kill the Valenhal incarnation. And, secretly, Alan wished him well. Grandmaster Naraka's eyelids fluttered open, and for a moment she stared blindly at the ceiling.
"Darren," she whispered.
Alan grasped her right arm above the elbow. "Alan," he said gently. This wasn't the first time during the night that she had called out for someone he had never heard of, but it was the first time she had opened her eyes.
"Alan," she repeated.
Her eyes widened, and Alan noticed they were almost completely white.
"Eliadel, does the tree burn?"
She sounded eager, desperate, and on the edge of tears all at once, as though she were asking whether her son had returned alive from a battle. Alan shook his head, and when she didn't seem to notice, he spoke. The tree still stands. A tear flowed down the crags of Grandmaster Naraka's face, and she shut her eyes again, sagging as if about to drift back into sleep.
"So close," she whispered. "I was so close."
"I couldn't leave you there to die," Alan said. "I had to protect you."
"No, no, you didn't."
"But the Valenhall Traveler would have killed you."
"Yes, he would have. And I would have died, knowing that the world would be free again. Everything I've worked for."
Her strength left her, and she fell back against her pillows, tears wetting her face. Alan stood and left the room, barely acknowledging the Naraka travelers who waited, alert, guarding her door. Two lurked inside and two outside, in case someone managed to slip through an undefended route in some territory. Each of the travelers looked so grim that Alan almost pitied the next maid to come with clean linens. She was likely to be torn apart by summoned beasts if she so much as sneezed next to the Grandmaster's bed. Should he even call her Grandmaster Naraka anymore? Surely the Grandmasters would have to appoint someone else to that position, now that her marked hand had been severed. Eventually, he was sure they could find a way to brand her left hand instead, but it would take days, maybe weeks, to heal her hand to the point where she could use it effectively. Ralia had been very clear on that point. Until she recovered, who would perform the Grandmaster's duty in her place? With a wash of guilt, Alan realized he had never even learned her real name. The guards nodded to Alan as he walked out of the former Grandmaster's room. All the Enosh travelers had treated Alan with respect before, but now that he had saved their Grandmaster's life, the Naraka travelers acted as though he were one of their own. Alan wandered aimlessly through the halls, still too focused to give in to his body's demands for sleep. He didn't intend to head anywhere specific. He simply let his feet drift where they would. It was so early in the morning that the sky was still gray, so he barely saw anyone. That suited him just now. Eventually, he found himself in front of a lone door. It was almost plain compared to the rest of the palace. Made of wood, not stone, and only polished rather than etched with fancy carvings. The room where his sisters stayed. Before he thought about it too hard, he knocked. "I probably shouldn't," he realized a second too late. "They're probably still sleeping. I should be talking to the Grandmasters. We should be planning our next move." But he stayed where he was. Less than a minute later, Alana pulled open the door. She wore a blouse and a long skirt, colorful, like the fashions here, rather than the earth tones more common in Myria, and she had her hair tied back. She looked as though she were going shopping, not just waking up. "Alan," she said, surprised, "don't you have some sort of deadly war mission today?" Alan blinked, for a moment not realizing what she meant. Then it hit him. Most of the city still thought they were preparing to attack Damasca. No one knew they already had. He probably shouldn't tell her. Secrecy was another of those things that the Grandmasters prized far more than he did. But the words were out of his mouth before he could stop them. "That's over. It, didn't go so well." She looked at him for a moment, and her expression softened. "Come on in," she said, stepping back. Alan followed her direction. "What are you doing up? It's hardly dawn." Ilana laughed. "Have you forgotten your life so quickly? I've woken up at dawn every day of my life. I'm not about to start lazing around now. A farm doesn't run itself." "You're not on the farm anymore, Ilana," Alan replied. "You don't have to go back ever again if you don't want to." She eyed him out of the corner of her eye as she drew him into their suite of rooms. "Why wouldn't I want to?" Tamara was standing at a table, working a floured lump of dough with her fists. She pushed hair out of her eyes with the back of one hand. "We have cooks for that," Alan said wearily.
"Am I not a cook now?" Tamara replied.
She remained as even and placid as usual, not showing the slightest hint of pleasure or surprise at seeing him. "You'll have to go to the kitchens to use the oven anyway," he pointed out. "While you're down there, you could get some bread they've already baked."
I could have someone pick out my clothes and dress me, too.
Shai, at least, had adapted to the easy life in Enosh. She was curled up like a cat on the seat of an enormous padded chair, a pile of collected knick-knacks spread around her like a bird's nest. Glancing over, Alan saw an egg the size of his fist, a glass bottle, several paces of sea-green twine, and a wind-up mouse that skittered across the floor on its own power. His youngest sister still slept, the clockwork mouse clutched in her hands as though she dreamed of dismantling it to its components.
"We don't have time to lay about, Alan," Ilana said.
"You do have time, you just don't choose to use it," he countered.
"We are using it. That's the whole point." "How bad was it?" Tamara interrupted.
She didn't look up, continuing to knead dough between her hands. She had a habit of doing that, cutting through to the heart of a discussion without even seeming to pay attention. A lump rose in Alan's throat. "Bad," he said.
"Tell me."
He recounted the entire operation, from being wakened in the dark of the night to dragging Grandmaster Naraka to Elysia for healing, and finally back to her rooms. "She's still recovering there, even now," he said. "She woke up a few minutes ago. She said she wishes I would have left her there." Ilana and Tamara stood in silence. Tamara absently wiped at her hands with a damp towel, her dough safely packed into a basket. Even Shai was awake now, perched on the arm of her huge chair. The sun loomed outside the curtain window. The story must have taken longer than he had thought.
"So you were supposed to destroy the hanging tree," Ilana said. "Then you release the incarnation or incarnations? One of them or all of them?"
Alan shrugged. "The Grandmasters talk like both of those are the same thing. Maybe if you release one, they all get released."
"There's already one," Shai said.
Ilana shuddered visibly. "Then I don't know," Alan said. "They said the Valenhall incarnation is here in the palace, but I haven't seen him."
"We have," Tamara said. "Yesterday, when you were still busy with Grandmaster Naraka."
Alan perked up. He had imagined the incarnations as giant, towering monsters. Really? What was he like? Even now, part of him was disappointed that they had gotten to see the incarnation before he had.
"Terrible," Shai said quietly.
"He's not that bad," Ilana put in. "Sure, he's dark and horrible and violent, and he seems like he would murder you if you looked at him wrong. Oh, and the room keeps rebuilding itself around him, and I could have sworn I saw one of his shadows kidnap somebody." The other three all stared at her.
"What?"
Ilana asked, a sarcastic tint to her voice. "That's not that bad. I can see why you'd want him around."
"Why would the Grandmasters want any of those monsters released?" Tamara asked.
Alan opened his mouth to defend them, but he realized he didn't know what he was going to say. "Because Damasca imprisoned them? That was hardly enough reason to release the incarnations on Damasca's citizens. The average Damascan didn't understand about incarnations or sacrifices." "To stop the sacrifice? More than 9 people would die this year if even one incarnation was set free, much less all of them." "Because it was the natural order?" Ilana clapped her hand on his shoulder. "Well, for now, don't worry about it. Stay and have breakfast with us. We'll go down to the kitchens to finish this bread, and I think one of the helpers is saving me some soup." Ilana kept talking, with occasional input from Shai or Tamara, but Alan stopped listening. For the moment, he could stay with his sisters and pretend they were all back home. Since when had he wanted that? Chapter 15, Succession. Surrounded by the workshop, Indiriel looked like he had just discovered a hoard of treasure.
"This is where he designed the advisors," he said in awe. He pulled a black string off a nearby workstation and lifted it into the air. The string curled lazily in midair, drifting down much slower than it should have, as though it were sliding through water.
"These materials must have come from foreign territories," Indiriel said.
"Amazing."
The overlord reached into a small leather purse, pulling out a tiny dark gem that almost looked black. He removed his medallion, comparing the gem at the center of the medallion to the gem he held in his other hand.
The two were identical.
"How did you find this?"
he breathed. Simon looked to Alyssa, who shrugged.
"We've all been sharing my daughter's bedroom, and I used to spend most of my days doing things that the Nye could probably do better for themselves. The eldest asked if I needed something to do, and I've always been a bit of a tinkerer."
Indiriel's face soured, and he put the gem back in its purse. "The eldest, huh?"
"Why?" she asked. "Is there something wrong?"
"Not exactly, no." Indiriel glanced at Simon as though asking for help. Simon wasn't sure he could explain, but he tried.
"The eldest wants the territory to grow and expand, and..."
"Well, that's all he wants. He doesn't care about us." Indiriel nodded. "It would have been nice to think that you had earned your way in here on your own, or that the territory had for some reason decided to open this place back up. But if the eldest's involved, that means he thinks there's some way to increase Valenhall's power."
Alyssa looked unconvinced. "Is that bad?"
"Depends on your definition of bad," Indiriel responded.
Simon waited for more, but the Overlord didn't seem inclined to say anything else. "Well, if you don't want to tell me, say so," Alyssa said. "No need to be so cryptic."
Deliberately, Alyssa turned from Indiriel to Simon.
"Would you mind helping me for a moment, Simon?"
she asked. Her voice was almost too pleasant.
"No, ma'am," Simon said, looking away from Indiriel. The Overlord's eyebrows were raised, and he looked as though he were trying to decide whether to be amused or offended. Simon wondered how long it had been since anyone dared to talk to Indiriel like that.
Alyssa reached into a nearby cabinet and withdrew the mask. It had improved since Simon last saw it. Polished steel silver on one side, and wrought iron black on the other, with a jagged line through the middle like a solid lightning bolt. There were small eye slits, one on each side, though they still looked too small to see out of. Clapping the mask down on a table in front of Simon, Alyssa looked him in the eye.
"Put it on, if you don't mind," she said.
Simon looked from her to the mask, then back at her again. On the one hand, if it gave him anything near the power it had given Malachi, he could find a use for it. On the other hand, he couldn't believe something like this would be without drawbacks. Probably significant drawbacks. Plus, it was homemade. He was willing to trust the artifacts left by the Wanderer, and he had no problem with those native to the territory. But something Alyssa had cobbled together out of an artifact she undoubtedly didn't understand. What he had learned in Enosh led Simon to believe that this mask was from Ragnaros, and that further reinforced his suspicion that there would be some horrible cost to wearing the mask. His imagination leapt into action, providing him with disturbing images of the mask sprouting limbs of sharp metal, driving into his skull and drinking his blood.
"What are you waiting for?" Alyssa said. "It's perfectly safe. It used to have all sorts of nasty side effects, but we think that was because it was broken. It won't drain your life force anymore."
"What is that?" Indiriel asked curiously. Simon had a different question in mind. "It drained your life force before?" Alyssa waved that away.
"Well, it doesn't now. Now it draws on your connection to Valenhall. It's like calling your, you know, steel or whatever. Just much deeper."
Indiriel eyed Alyssa suspiciously. "How do you know all this? Where did you learn how to do anything with the artifacts of a territory?" Alyssa raised her eyebrows at him.
"The library," she said,
in a tone that made it clear that this subject wasn't any of his business. She relented after a few more seconds, adding,
"Some of it the eldest taught me. Some of it I learned from documents in the workshop. Some things I just know now. The longer I spend in the workshop, the more I know."
"That kind of link can be dangerous," Indiriel warned. "I know you're not familiar with..."
Indiriel kept talking, but Simon stopped listening. He had heard enough. Now he was faced with a simple choice. Would he wear the mask or not? Taking a deep breath, Simon made up his mind. He needed an edge against Valen, and this mask might be it. If this would help him defeat the Incarnation, or even to last a little longer against him, he would be willing to take a little risk. Simon took the mask in one hand and, with only a moment's hesitation, pressed it against his face.
"Simon, wait," Indiriel commanded. He took his hand away, and the mask stayed. It didn't feel like it was glued to his face, and there was certainly nothing wrapping around his head. So how did it stay on?
"I don't feel any different," Simon said. His voice sounded tinny and muffled behind the mask. He had been right about the eye slits. He could focus on either Olyssa's hands resting on the table or her face, not both at once. Olyssa nodded absently and scratched something down on a piece of paper.
"Good, okay. Andra managed to get this far. Now, can you call one of your Valenhall powers?"
"Hold on a moment, Simon," Indiriel said. Olyssa huffed impatiently and turned toward the Overlord.
"What is it now?"
"I can't believe this is safe," Indiriel responded evenly. "Let me try it."
"I'm more comfortable with Simon, thank you," Olyssa said, once again in that too sweet voice. "I hardly know you. Do you have any reason to believe it isn't safe?"
Indiriel hesitated a moment before saying, "Nothing tangible, just experience. I don't expect anything to be safe."
"Well, unless you have something more concrete, please trust me." She smiled reassuringly at him. "Don't worry, I've been here a while now. I know my way around."
Indiriel sighed and shook his head, but he didn't say anything else. Simon watched the two in silence. They were treating him like a child. He could almost understand that attitude, since he was a child to them. And if Indiriel knew something about the mask that Simon didn't, he certainly wanted to hear it. But this was his decision, not theirs. Before Olyssa could say anything else, he called Steel. The liquid cold flowed through his veins and along his muscles, not like a river, but like the torrents of an ocean. He felt as though his limbs would freeze, but at the same time, he felt as though he could tear the walls of the house down with his bare hands. He could see perfectly, too, as though the mask had become completely transparent. The sudden input of sight and sensation almost blinded him, and he staggered to the right, gripping the corner of a metal table for balance. The metal warped and bent under his fingers. Indiriel looked down at the medallion he was still holding in one hand, then up at Simon. His expression was a combination of horror and readiness for battle.
"Take it off, Simon! Simon, take it off!" "Is it working?" Olyssa asked eagerly. "How do you feel?"
He felt like he could leap over a mountain. No, through a mountain. He felt like summoning Azura and tearing his way through the rest of the house, deeper and deeper, until he had carved into the center of the Wanderer's world. He felt like tearing an incarnation apart with nothing but his hands. Experimentally, Simon reached out to the Nye essence. He nudged the power in his mind, intending to take only a wisp of that chill moonlight power. It slammed into his lungs, causing him to take a deep, involuntary breath. It was like waking up after a century of sleep. Olyssa's pen locked into place, and Indiriel froze in the middle of a step forward. Simon concentrated in a way he had never tried before, and Olyssa's hand crawled forward, writing on the paper. Indiriel lowered his foot a fraction of an inch. Simon loosened his grip a little further, and the pen scratched, Indiriel opening his mouth to speak. Simon tightened his focus on the nigh breath, and the world froze again. He had to do something with all this power, so he coiled his legs and leaped. Even through this frozen world, he moved like a stone launched from a catapult. "Too fast, too fast, too fast," he thought desperately.
"Try to grab a ceiling beam," Kayla said.
She sounded exasperated. For some reason, the Nye essence hadn't frozen her voice. Simon spun in midair, snagging one of the solid wood ceiling beams that arched over the workshop. He managed to halt his progress, though the beam itself creaked alarmingly under his impact.
"How can I understand you?" Simon asked. "That's a great question of the ages," Kayla responded. "How do you manage to keep up with my shining intellect?"
Simon let that comment slide. "No," he said. "I mean, why aren't you as slow as everything else?"
"Ah," Kayla said. "We're not really talking, you know."
Sure we are, Simon said. Kayla sighed, but she sounded pleased with herself.
We are transmitting our thoughts directly. It's much more efficient than speech. I'm not sure why you ever bother moving your mouth at all.
That's good, Simon responded, letting himself drop down to his former position. Now I won't have to worry about leaving you behind when I wear the mask.
So, you've decided to use the mask, have you?
Why wouldn't I?
A question you ought to consider carefully.
Simon shook his head wearily. All his doubts had flown away in the face of this wonderful rush of power. Surely even Valen couldn't stand against him like this. If Kayla wasn't convinced, well, he was used to doubt and mockery from the dolls. He wouldn't let that stop him. He loosened his grip on the Nye essence enough that he could see Olyssa blinking in surprise. He wondered why for a moment, and then understood. From her perspective, he had been standing in one place and appeared inches away. She hadn't seen him move. The thought thrilled him, and he turned to Indiriel. He saw the man just as his broad hand smacked Simon upside the face. The mask flew free, and the world lurched back into normal speed. The mask hit the wall and rang like a bell before it crashed down to the floor.
What was...
Simon tried to ask, what was that for? But his mouth seemed not to have the energy it needed to move. He attempted to step toward Indiriel, but his legs gave out, and he melted bonelessly to the stone floor. Alyssa's mouth gaped open in shock.
What happened?
At the end of the hallway, beyond the bedrooms, there is a trap door beneath a rug, Indiriel said. Go there, raise the door, and call for the eldest. Tell him that Indiriel needs a favor.
I haven't seen the eldest for, Alyssa said, but Indiriel cut her off.
The eldest will be where he needs to be. Do as I say, and under no circumstances climb down the ladder. Do you understand me? No matter what he says, do not climb down the ladder. Alyssa's face struggled with itself, and she glanced down at Simon, but finally she obeyed. Simon wasn't surprised. Even if he hadn't known that Indiriel was a Damascan overlord, the authority in the man's voice would have sent him running. He tried to say something, but his mouth wouldn't obey. He ordered his hand to move, but his fingers only twitched. His body had no strength at all. Well, there's one cure for that, he thought. He called Steel. Nothing happened.
You've used it all up, Kayla said. I warned you.
You didn't warn me.
Well, I would have, if you asked. Why didn't you ask?
Simon would have throttled her, if he could move. And if it would have done any good to throttle someone with a wooden neck.
What happened to my steel? I didn't use that much. I'm not sure, she admitted. It felt full the entire time you had the mask on, as though it wasn't draining at all. But, as soon as the mask fell off, it went straight to empty.
Indiriel knelt over by the wall, covering his hand in the corner of his cloak, and gingerly picking up the mask without ever touching the metal with his hand. Simon didn't think he had the strength to turn his head, but he heard the rustle of cloth next to his ear. A rasping voice spoke from above him.
What happened here?
The eldest asked. He leaned over Simon's body for a better look, his dark hood peering into Simon's eyes. What do you know about this? Indiriel demanded. He raised the mask up for the Nye's inspection, still not touching it with his skin.
An artifact of Ragnaros, captured in battle from a defeated foe. It meets the requirements to become part of Valenhall.
It's from Ragnaros, Indiriel said. It can't be safe. Look what it did to Simon. The eldest's hood snapped up to regard Indiriel.
I would have thought that, of all people, you would not be squeamish about using the power of the Crimson Vault. You should know that nothing in Ragnaros is less than a powerful weapon. If you mean to stop the incarnation, I should think that you would relish every weapon you can get your hands on.
Without responding, Indiriel strode over to Simon and reached down, holding up Simon's limp arm. And what about this? The Overlord asked. At first, Simon thought he meant the fact that he couldn't move after only seconds using the mask. That was Simon's main concern, certainly. He looked at his arm. It was covered by a design like black chains.
the chains twisted all the way up to his shoulders. He hadn't noticed before because of the icy chill of the mask's power and his subsequent collapse, but he could feel the chains crawling past his shoulder blades and onto his back, binding his ribs in what felt like cold steel. "Maker above," he thought. "This is what happens when he only has the mask on for a few seconds," Endiriel said. "What happens if he tries to fight Valen in it?"
"I'm not convinced you should be fighting Valen at all," the eldest rasped. "Besides, if you are so concerned for the boy's welfare, you can wear the mask. I do not care."
Alyssa came rushing into the workshop. "I shouted down that trap door till I was hoarse. I don't know what you expected to happen, but..." Then she noticed the scene. Endiriel, kneeling next to Simon, holding up his chain-wrapped arm for emphasis. The eldest Nye, standing over them both, turning his hood to regard her as she walked in the door. Simon could only see the whole picture out of the corner of his eye, but he had to admit, it made for a strange situation.
"Eldest," Alyssa said, sounding surprised. "You're here."
"I knew where I was needed," the eldest responded, turning back to Endiriel. "Why did you need me, son of Elias? My master may call for me at any moment, and I must be ready."
Endiriel stood, standing face to face with the eldest. He rose head and shoulders above the Nye, but the eldest certainly didn't back down. "Why did you bring her here?" Endiriel asked. "Why open this room up at all?"
"I use what resources I am given. When I see someone so rich in imagination, in potential, I must have her working for the house. That is all. What she creates, that is no concern of mine. This mask is nothing. She is the real treasure."
Simon couldn't see Alyssa's face, but she was probably wondering whether to be flattered or creeped out. That was how Simon would have felt, at least. "We will not take the mask," Endiriel said. "You will not bind us as you bound Valen." The eldest spread his arms wide, his sleeves drooping down to the floor.
"You wound me, son of Elias. Even if you wish to take the mask from here, it would not function for you outside of the territory. It is not yet attuned."
Endiriel stared, obviously considering that. Simon, feeling strength return to his limbs, struggled up to a sitting position, propping himself up against the wall.
"What?"
he began, but his voice trailed off and he had to swallow. Both Endiriel and the eldest looked at him.
"What would it take
to do this attuning thing?" Endiriel ran a hand through his hair, not looking at Simon. "We can't use this, Simon. We can't. It's too great a risk. Instead of beating Valen, we could actually make him stronger." The eldest ignored Endiriel, rubbing his sleeves together, his hood turned toward Simon.
"I, or someone like me, would have to bind the mask to a specific room and a specific challenge. Anyone with enough ties to the house could attune an artifact if it meets the correct requirements. If they did so, you would be able to summon it in the outside world."
"Do it," Simon said, but Endiriel snatched the mask away. "I know what it looked like, Simon," he said, "but this is exactly the kind of thing that snared Valen in the first place. We can't afford the risk." The eldest shrugged.
"It does not matter."
Both travelers looked at him.
"It does not matter," he said again. "I will not do it."
"What? Why not?"
"For me, there is no gain," the eldest said in his grating, almost whisper. "If you can summon the mask, you will challenge the Valenol incarnation. You will likely die, and my investment in you will be wasted. Or else you will kill Valen, and still I have nothing to show for it."
The eldest Nye turned his back and glided from the room.
"So no, son of Kalmon, I will not do this thing. Be at ease, Overlord."
The Nye vanished.
"Excuse me," Alyssa said, "but I made it. I think I should get to say something about..."
Something seemed to hit her, and she stopped in mid-sentence. Almost comically slow, she rotated her neck to look at Indiriel. In a small voice, she said,
Overlord.
Indiriel kept looking at the mask, answering in an absent voice. Hmm? Oh, yes. Indiriel, son of Elias, overlord of the realm of Cana, subject to the authority of His Majesty Zacharith the Sixth, the Morning and Evening Star, and so on and so forth. From the small smile quirking up the corner of Indiriel's mouth, Simon didn't think he was quite as casual as he pretended. Olyssa looked like she was about to faint. Hastily, she pulled the goggles from her hair and tossed her pen down, smoothing the front of her dress.
I thought...
She glanced around, looking for answers, but soon decided to go to her knees in a deep bow.
"How may I serve you, my lord?" she asked.
Indiriel looked vaguely uncomfortable.
"Get up, woman. Seriously, get up. I never can get used to that."
Olyssa rose to her feet, still looking flustered.
"I should get my husband. Yes. My children need to meet you."
He raised his hands as though she had threatened him. "No, no, don't do that. They would only make more of a fuss." Her eyes moved to Simon, and they widened.
"Simon, is he working for you? With you? But he..."
She clicked her mouth shut, but Simon could have finished the sentence for her. "But he kills Damascans." Indiriel sighed and shook his head. "This is a mess. Listen, I am well aware of Simon's past, but he is working with me now, not against me, and therefore he will have the opportunity to make up for his past crimes. Such is the decree I received straight from King Zacharith himself. Do you understand?"
"Absolutely clear, my lord,"
Olyssa said. She looked upon Indiriel as though he was the maker himself, and Simon only a step short. The looks made Simon uncomfortable. They reminded him too much of the way people treated Alan. "Yes, well, let your family know," Indiriel said. "I know your daughter was chosen to bear a dragon's fang. You are to be congratulated. When she's ready, she'll have an honored place in the kingdom." She looked as though Indiriel had offered her a house full of gold. Indiriel held up the mask. "For now, hold on to this. Don't give it to anyone, especially not one of the Nye. It was an honor to meet you, Mistress Agnos. Let's go, Simon." As they walked out of the room, well, Indiriel walked, and Simon sort of staggered along behind him. Simon asked the question. "Shouldn't you have hidden the mask? If the eldest wants it, he knows right where to find it." "I would have," the overlord responded, "but there's no point. I couldn't hide it from him, so I might as well leave it where I can keep my eye on it." "Okay, where are we going?" Indiriel looked at him in surprise, his eyebrows raised. "Well, I'll have to go as soon as the king contacts me. But until then, it's been far too long since I've spent any significant time in the house. It's about time I settled in for a long overdue workout." He clapped a hand on Simon's shoulder, almost causing Simon's still weak knees to collapse. "And you, my friend, will get to see some real training." Alan was finally beginning to relax when, for the second time that day, a grandmaster called him to work. He was sitting between Shai and Alana, tearing into a roast pork sandwich, listening to Shai tell a story about how she had managed to find her way into the Tartarus Traveler's barracks. Tamara spent half her time chuckling, and the other half shaking her head, as though trying to decide whether to be an amused older sister or a disapproving mother. Then Shai cut off mid-sentence, and Alan put down his sandwich. He didn't have to look up to know why she had stopped. He had been lucky to get even this much time to himself. He barely stopped to marvel at how much he was changing. Only last week, he would have been overjoyed at the idea of one of the Grandmasters needing his help. A Helgard traveler, unmistakable with his thick, fur-lined coat, his long beard, and the string of sharpened bones he wore around his neck, placed one gloved hand on Alan's shoulder.
"The Grandmaster would like to speak with you," the man said. His glove still had bits of frost on it, which melted and trickled down Alan's neck.
Alan stood, bidding his sisters goodbye, and followed the traveler out of the room.
"You are not dressed as you should be," the Hellguard traveler said disapprovingly, once they had left the dining room.
Alan responded as he felt a king would have.
"I am dressed as I wish," he said.
The traveler grunted, unimpressed, but Alan felt good. That was what King Zachareth would have said, he was sure. Well, that was what he imagined. Alan followed the traveler along what seemed like miles of twisting corridor, all the way to the Hellguard quarters. These were rougher than most of the palace, made largely out of undressed stone or undecorated metal, and he would have sworn that he saw patches of actual snow in some of the corners. The man led Alan to a huge arch of a door, made of a metal that looked like pewter, carved with the snarling face of some horned, bear-like beast. Without knocking, the traveler pulled the door open, pushing Alan inside. The room was larger than Alan had expected, larger even than the Grandmaster's War Council room. It was surrounded with packed bookshelves and comfortable furniture, and one wall was nothing but high windows. The windows had curtains drawn over them now, and the only light came from a series of candles sitting around the room. They were placed well away from the books, Alan noticed. Someone had hastily cleared out the center of the room and placed a round table there, surrounding it with chairs. All those chairs, save one, were now occupied. Grandmaster Avernus sat at the end of the table, her long gray hair hastily tied back. Judging by her casual robes, someone had woken her for this meeting. She stared at a man Alan didn't recognize. He was tall and well-muscled, with blonde curly hair framing a face that said he was bored with these proceedings, and he was already looking forward to more important business later in the day. His hands were bound to the arms of his chair, and a sword, presumably his, lay on the table in front of him. The sheath was pulled down slightly to expose a few inches of bright red steel. The prisoner's calm was even more impressive considering his circumstances. A fat, fluffy owl, with eyes that gleamed unnaturally bright in the room's candlelight, perched on the table across from him, staring fixedly into the bound man's eyes. Or, possibly, it could have been watching the serpents crawl all over his clothes. These serpents looked like 2-foot-long snakes, except they each had 4 or 5 pairs of spindly claws that helped them grip and pull themselves along the prisoner's skin. When they passed his head, they stopped to flick a tongue inside his ear and hiss something that sounded disturbingly like a secret whisper.
"What is going on here?" Alan asked.
Grandmaster Endros stood next to Avernus, his dark eyes fixed on the prisoner. His hands rested on the hilts of his swords, as though he was looking for an opportunity to use them. Upon hearing Alan speak, he glanced over, but he didn't say a word. It was the last Grandmaster in the Council who responded. Grandmaster Hellguard glared at the prisoner over his bushy beard, one hand curling almost unconsciously into a fist. He spoke to Alan, though.
"Eliadel, this man claims to be Talos, firstborn son of Zachareth VI, and heir to the Damascan throne."
Before Alan could say anything, before he could even decide what he wanted to say, Talos spoke.
"You can stop testing me now. You know I am who I say I am, and you know that what I offer is the truth."
He leaned forward, looking from Grandmaster to Grandmaster before finally settling his gaze on Alan.
"I want to help you," he said.
Leah pushed her bleeding hand to the silver doors of Ragnaros. The doors, marked with the visage of the bearded, one-eyed king, swung silently open at her offering. Not for the first time, Leah pressed a handkerchief against the slice in her hand and wished there was some other, more civilized way to gain entry to the Crimson Vault. She was getting sick of pinpricks. Her father stood within, for once wearing his tall black-and-gold crown, a ruby set above his forehead. He held a blunt mace in one hand and the hilt of a long sword, slightly curved and sharp along only one edge, like Simon's, in the other. He seemed to be comparing the two, looking from one to the other. Leah had expected to find him here.
He liked to spend his time in the vault. Somehow, examining the weapons soothed him or set his mind at ease. This was as relaxed as she ever saw him, rigidly looking from one deadly weapon to another, as though trying to decide which to unleash first. He looked up as she entered.
Leah, you have something to report.
I do, Father. As usual, she had to fight the urge to bow or curtsy in his presence. The crystal I planted in Enosh has gone dark. I have no more eyes in the city. His crimson eye flared.
Discovered.
She hesitated but shook her head.
I don't believe so.
I doubt it's been destroyed, only blocked somehow. I suspect Grandmaster Lyriel or one of her lieutenants has created interference on the Lyriel side. The king nodded, carefully replacing his weapons on their labeled marble shelves.
Will it be useless to us, then?
Possibly, Leah allowed. Grandmaster Lyriel may know some tricks that I do not. But if she hasn't discovered the exact location of the crystal, any block she creates will be temporary. It will be all but impossible to maintain as the moons shift.
Keep me apprised, her father said.
Leah bowed her head a fraction and turned to leave.
You've never tried to have me killed, King Zachareth said suddenly.
Leah froze with her back to the king, afraid to move. Her father never spoke idly. His every word had a purpose. Was this a trap? Had she walked into an ambush?
Nor have you ever attempted to secure your succession by eliminating your competition, he continued. At first, I assumed that was because you lacked the stomach to do what was necessary. But I no longer believe that to be the case. So, why?
Warily, she turned to face her father. Never in her entire life had her father asked her such an intimate question. He had asked her to provide him with information, had questioned her about her decisions or her motivations, but he had never asked about her. So, she had no choice but to assume this was a trap.
An attack on you would have destabilized the realm, she said carefully, and an attack on my brothers or sisters would have jeopardized the succession, which could result in panic or a lack of confidence in the royal family. As the Sinaran law code states, no noble may take actions that advance personal gains at the risk of national stability, on pain of...
King Zachareth laughed. It was a short, bitter bark of a laugh, but it startled his daughter so much that she stopped, her mouth practically gaping open. She couldn't recall ever having heard her father laugh. He didn't even laugh sarcastically, mockingly, or for emphasis. Laughing seemed too human for him, somehow.
I don't want the law code's answer, he said at last. I want yours.
It took Leah a moment to answer.
I wasn't sure the prize was worth the cost, she said at last.
Zachareth nodded as though he understood. Maybe he did.
I had intended your sister Sinara to take the throne, before her accident in Asphodel. She had your intelligence, but she had the spirit as well, the drive to do whatever it took.
She was ruthless, Leah said. Cruel.
Yes.
Zachareth stood for a moment, ruminating.
Once I thought those things virtues. Even after Sinara became unsuitable for the throne,